Welcome to Focus on Southeast, a monthly program on issues and events impacting the campus of Southeast Missouri State University. I'm Dan Woods, General Manager of KRCU Public Radio, Southeast Missouri's NPR station. Today we're talking with Southeast President Carlos Vargas, and we'll spend some time today talking about the latest on the budget, a tuition increase, and much more. Dr. Vargas, welcome once again.
Welcome, Dan. Thank you very much. It's very good to see you.
Good to see you as well. The Board of Regents, as you know, of course, met on the 12th of May and approved a 2.8% tuition increase that will take effect in fall of 2017. What kind of impact will that increase have on the university's budget, which I know has been challenging as of late?
Well, yes, it is going to be challenging. That increase is going to help us absorb some of the cuts that are being implemented on higher education, and some of them, are, of course, are affecting us. We have been working on that from the moment that the cuts were announced by Governor Greitens, and so we kept working and developed a plan, really a multi-year plan, to address this, because we thought that doing a one-year plan really was not the best way to proceed at this point. And so we did a three-year plan, and we have identified a number of ways of absorbing those cuts, those reductions. But it was going to be extremely difficult for us to really be able to take the whole, to absorb all the cuts without increasing our tuition. As you know, and I hope everybody knows, your listeners know, is that we value access and affordability tremendously at the university. We want to make it as easy as possible for students to be able to enroll in college and to finish their degree. So we ended up in the end having to propose this 2.8% increase to the tuition, which was approved on May 12th by the Board of Regents. The 2.8% really corresponds to $6.50 per credit hour for the university, so that's what we're going to be doing. And as you mentioned, the Board of Regents approved it. We did have very detailed and thorough conversations with the Regents, justifying the reason why we wanted to do this, because the regions themselves are very committed to affordability in education. So that's what happened this May 12th, and I think we're going to be able to deal with this budget cuts as we move forward.
Are we looking ahead to FY18? Do we have any sense of what the state appropriation will look like? Is there going to be any early looks at that at this point?
Well, they actually ended up proposing a 6.58% reduction instead of the 9% that the governor had originally proposed. So it looks better than what we were thinking. To be honest, in years past, we have experienced a situation where we have been given maybe a small increase, with the idea that with the understanding that we wouldn't increase tuition, so we're always trying to balance those two things. But in the past, what's happened sometimes is that we actually have had a withholding halfway through the year. And so we are just being cautious here. We don't want to sing victory at this point. We want to be cautious and realize that because we're not really sure exactly how the revenue is going to end up being, that we want to not necessarily change at this point our projections, but wait until we are into the year. So.
And that's probably one of the reasons why there was a three-year plan,
yes.
Because things can change, as you know.
That is absolutely right. So, if we were to have extra funds that we were not thinking we're going to have, we might be able to absorb the cuts that we actually were planning for next year, maybe earlier. So it's not like we actually are going to have extra money to do discretionary things. Every cent that really was cut, this is a cent that has been going to important initiatives in the university to focus on student success, on our ability to help students graduate and in a timely fashion and with as little debt as possible.
Let's spend a little time talking about just the Board of Regents in general. So many other things were approved, but kind of give our viewers just a peek behind the scenes. What are some of the things that the board does when they meet?
Sure. Good. Great question. The board meets anywhere from 4 to 6 times a year. And when we meet, we present to the board information in many cases, reports in many cases, and in some cases, items for action. As an example of what we do, for example, this last meeting in May, one of the things that they did, which is of paramount importance, is to approve the list of candidates for graduation. Many people don't know, but actually before we go to commencement, the Board of Regents has to formally approve the list of candidates. That's a process that every institution pretty much follows. So we did that. It happened to be the day before the actual commencement, but we did that. Another item that we did is we've presented to them a proposal for the honorary doctorate that the university offered to Mr. Douglas C. Green, now Dr. Green, okay. For his in recognizing his contributions and efforts on behalf of the university. We also provided them with information on some program changes, academic programs. So if every time we introduce a new degree or a new area, we need to go to the Board of Regents for approval before we can move that forward. So we also share with them the status of some of the projects that are going on related to facilities at the university, so they keep up with what's happening in the different areas. For example, they approved the modifications to Growl, the renovations to Growl sometime in the past. Now we're working on them. So we're always updating that. And they see the tuition and fee schedule, of course, as you mentioned, already was approved. And if you have any course fees or so for some particular courses that need materials, we present it to them. So those are the kind, and we discuss with them hiring, resignations, retirements or so that take place. So we just keep them informed, because the responsibility has to do with setting policy, approving the budget, hiring or firing the president, those kinds of things. So, as I said, they meet 4 to 6 times a year. And one of those times, there's a retreat where they actually have an extended period of time to talk about items that require some discussion, conversation, to update them on trends in higher education, for them to get a more in-depth view as to some of the areas that we're doing, we're working on, and so on.
And members of the Board of Regents are appointed by the governor?
They're all appointed by the governor. We have 7 members of the board. One is a student, also appointed by the governor. And then there are 6 members. Currently, we, of course, have those 6 members. It's a very good working group. I love working with them. They really are very supportive, very engaged with the university. I'm pleased with the way we work.
The Southeast Era, which is the university's student publication, recently did an in-depth report on sexual violence on campus. And if folks are interested in that, they can see it online at southeastarrow.com. But what I want to ask you about specifically is, what is Southeast Missouri State University doing about sexual assaults to combat that here on campus?
Well, it's a great question and also a very profound one. There is no doubt that I am terribly troubled by the fact that sexual assault, sexual violence occurs at all on campus and outside of campus in the community. Having said that, we are working hard to make sure that we improve the ability that we have to reduce that, to avoid that. We are very pleased with the fact that, not only the Arrow has shed light on it, but also that there are students in the student body at the university that are actually very actively trying to create awareness of that, because creating of awareness is actually, I believe, a very effective deterrent for that to happen. It is a difficult issue to deal with, because when that occurs, the person that has suffered the assault or the violence has a number of different options to follow. And so we need to respond depending on how he or she wants to proceed. And in some cases, they would really want to remain anonymous. In other cases, they are very they're ready and very vocal about making sure that they inform who they are. And in some cases, they want to file charges with the police. In some other cases, they don't. Or they may change their minds. So we need to be ready to respond to all that. We have a number of offices on campus that and programs that specifically focus on providing help to those students that may have suffered the violence. It is a little bit challenging, too, because as you saw in the report from the Arrow, there are lots of there are a lot of data out there, and it's, sometimes it's difficult to compare and identify that, because in some cases we are providing information resulting from the Clery Act. In other cases, and that involves certain actions that occurred in certain locations, like in, on the campus or just around the campus. And so what happens is we're now working the university in trying to in making sure that we have a very a clear and we're doing that through the through our website and one of our web pages to communicate to people the information, but also to indicate what the information represents, what it includes. One of the things that I think I'd like to take this opportunity to communicate to people is that we are absolutely not interested in not sharing this information. We want to be open. We want to be very transparent, and that's something that we are working to do. But we need to do it in such a way that we also do not create confusion out there. So we're working hard to make sure that our offices, they all understand what they're doing and they know how to communicate with each other. When a situation like this occurs, it's terribly, it's a tragedy for the person that is subject to this. And we immediately try to be of help, recognizing that the emotional trauma sometimes causes the person, the victim, to not necessarily know exactly what direction he or she wants to move in. And so we are trying to be supportive. We have counselors on campus. We, of course, have the Department of Public Safety, which is a commission where we have commissioned officers. So we do have the ability to carry out investigations. We can do it on our own, or we can ask for help from the Cape City Police. So we're trying to do this. I believe that one way that I think is effective, maybe not to the degree that it can absolutely eradicate those cases, but that can be very effective in reducing this incidence of violence, sexual violence, is to encourage bystanders, what we call the bystander intervention, which means other people that are around to help to identify situations that might be moving towards something like that happening and try to figure out a way to prevent it. And so bystander intervention, I think, is very important. Having students, friends go out and maybe sometimes and make sure that you don't leave anybody behind. Unfortunately, in many cases, alcohol is involved in these situations. Maybe not in all of them, but in many they are. And so how do you control that? How do you make students aware that alcohol may actually promote or increase the chances of something, an event like that happening, is very important. So we're working and we're being more explicit with the parents and the students when they come for orientation about how important it is that they be cautious, that they behave in ways that they minimize the chances of that happening.
A big topic, and I would just note to our viewers, if you're interested in the data, just go to southeastarrow.com and you can see the report that the students did, and all that information is there and it's available to review. Let's switch gears and talk about the new Center for Speech and Hearing, which was dedicated in early May, located on the corner of North Pacific and Watkins Drive, pretty close to where we're taping, actually, next to the Grau Building. So what services are offered to the center, and what does it mean for our region to have it here?
Well, it certainly is. It's a center that, of course, addresses issues with speech and hearing. And it's a facility I have visited. I had the chance to visit, and it's a wonderful facility that gives the community, actually, an opportunity to be exposed to some kind of therapy for problems that they may have with their speech or their hearing. I think that, I definitely applaud the university when those conversations and those discussions first started to have moved in this direction. When I came here, I continued being very supportive of it, and I am so pleased that now we have this facility, which provides enhanced opportunities for serving the community, but it also gave us the opportunity to move that activity outside of an academic building, Grau Building. And now we are in the process of renovating the building and be able to increase the number of offices and spaces devoted to classroom and also to student areas where they can actually have a lounge. And so we're going to be able to relocate some departments completely, like the English department is going to be there. Mass media is also going to have some facilities there in a much better quality. So the Center for Speech and Hearing is not only a resource in many ways similar to what the Center for Autism is that the university has, but it also has helped the university expand a little bit and improve the spaces that it has that we have for our students and our faculty. That Speech and Hearing Center is going to provide opportunities for students in communication disorders to be able to go and have an opportunity to observe more directly the treatment and the therapy that is provided to patients. And I have heard students who are actually just graduating now, and they're going to maybe graduate programs where they get there, and they may be coming from Southeast, which is not a Research One institution, but they will have had more exposure to individuals with those problems than students who come from very large programs in other locations. So they really have an advantage when they get there, and they're being very successful in achieving admission to graduate school.
You mentioned this earlier, but let's talk a little bit about Doug Green, who received an honorary doctoral degree at the spring commencement in May. And I spoke with him actually on the radio earlier this month. He's been quite the innovator during his career. You said that Doug has been a, quote, transformational figure at Southeast Missouri State. What did you mean by that?
He has been able to help us really operationalize in many ways this concept of entrepreneurialism. Or entrepreneurship. He is so committed and has this significant experience really being an entrepreneur that his drive and his passion and commitment to talking to students directly and working with the faculty is what in many ways became the driving force behind our creation of a number of minors that we have on entrepreneurship. And so in that sense, is that he has really helped us transform the institution. When you think about it, you could say, well, why couldn't the university just, you know, create these minors and entrepreneurship and, you know, what's difficult? Well, the difficulty is sometimes you need that person with that credibility that he has done it or she has done it, and that's what he has done. And so he and working with our faculty, who actually have been wonderful because they have been terribly receptive and have embraced this whole idea. And so now we actually have there's a mindset, certainly where it all started in the College of Business, on developing this this initiative on entrepreneurship. And he has been not only a vocal advocate for that, but he has contributed also his time and also his wealth, his fortune to help us move in that direction. And we have about 50 students that receive scholarships from him. The scholarships go to the foundation. The foundation offers them, but he's been the one that's done that. So it's just a wonderful opportunity, and he continues to be engaged with us. So I really couldn't think of any person who would more deserve to be recognized with a Doctor of Business honoris causa by the university. So I'm so happy, and I believe he is really very pleased that he's been recognized.
Let's spend our last few moments talking about naturalization. You became a citizen of the United States in July of 2016, almost a year ago now, and you recently spoke at a naturalization ceremony here in Cape this year. What did you say at that ceremony? I'm curious.
Very, very interesting. Well, first of all, I had a hard time just really recognizing that I had just become a citizen, and now I was there talking to them about becoming a citizen. And it was really, to me, it was very meaningful because I don't know if you know, but it took me 30 years from the moment I became first a legal resident to the moment I applied and was granted the citizenship. And that was for a variety of reasons. And I started the process a couple of times and just did not follow it through because I was busy doing things and all that. So when I got here, that was the third strike, so I needed to do it. And so what I told them is, I said, every one of us comes here, because there were about 16 or so individuals, less than 20, every one of us comes here following a very different path. Some of them come and after having suffered a lot of setbacks and challenges, and others come with very easily. And so I just said to them, I'm so pleased that you actually have arrived at this point and finally become a citizen. And I hope you're as excited and proud as I am.
Dr. Vargas, thank you once again for being here.
Thank you very much, Dan.